In O'Hare Airport testing to see if batteries are working.
Well, okay.
This is,
well, ignore it. Now put it down here.
I know it's there. No, that's okay.
Wherever I put it, you know it's there. Huh? Yeah. Well, you're not hooked up to a microphone or anything. We're just talking baseball. Today is March the 8th, the home of Ray Berry's. Who broke in 1929 with Waterloo.
I first started out at Oklahoma City.
You started out Oklahoma. Who signed you?
A guy by the name of Dick Crutcher. He was one of those players that I was telling you about with the play summer football. He was with Boston back in the days when they were what the heck did they call them, 1914 Marvelous.
Or the Miracle Braves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
By the name of Dick Crutcher. Well, he managed a little team for us in Kenosha, sponsored by Nash Motors at that time. And he asked me one time if I was interested in going out and see if I wanted to try out in professional ball, and he obtained a contract for me with Oklahoma City.
Was he a scout?
No, just he was retired from baseball, and he worked for Nash Motors at that time.
So he just kind of, he knew somebody in Oklahoma City and recommended you.
Recommended me.
Where does the name Berry's come from?
German.
Uh-huh. What was your parents' attitude toward you on Oklahoma City?
My dad passed away when I was a young lad.
Mm-hmm.
And just my mother, who didn't understand the whole situation. So it was my sisters and my brothers that kept encouraging me to give it a shot. What have you got to lose? So I went, and like so many eager beavers, you know, kids, I was going to show too much the first day and hurt my arm. And I couldn't throw all during spring training.
Did they send you the train fare?
That's right.
Yeah.
But when I got released, I had a pretty good spring with them, hitting and everything. And the manager liked me, but the owner, Mr. Holland, you remember John Holland? His dad owned the ball club at that time. And he didn't know whether I was going to be worth $1,000 to send me down to one of the clubs in the Cotton States League. And because he was going to have to spend $1,000, he was supposed to give this guy that sent me down there $1,000, and then there he was supposed to pay my salary in some club in the Cotton States League. And then, because of my arm being in the situation that it was, he thought it was just another kid that blew his chances. Well, anyway, the opening day of the season is when I got my release, and you get back the best way you can. So I had a hitchhike from Oklahoma City to Waterloo, Iowa.
Why Waterloo?
Because it was on my way home, and when we got to Waterloo, Iowa, I remembered that there was a kid from home trying out with that ball club. And I found out what hotel they were living at, so I looked him up and spent the night with him. He said, why don't you come out and come out and watch this work out, or I'll introduce you to the manager, maybe he'll give you a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And Cletus Dixon was a manager, and I told him what had happened. He said, well, how's your arm now? I said, I don't know. I haven't thrown in maybe a week. And he said, well, give me a uniform. We try out. And he said, the weather was a little cool. He said, just take things easy. He said, you be the judge of when you show me what you can do. So I was there a day or two, and I finally started throwing again. It felt pretty good. And the next day it felt better, and I said, I would just like to try it. He said, they don't ask me to throw too hard in infield work. So I threw, and I threw pretty well. The ball carried pretty good for me, around the infield practice. So the next day we came back out, and I put on a little more. I started out throwing the third, second, and around. And about the third round, I let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And he stopped everything. He said, hey, I don't want you throwing that hard again in this cold weather. Not for another week or so. And so that's how I got started.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a pretty good year. I hit a little over 300. And
what was your salary?
Oh, God, I know. I think I started out for about $75 a month.
Living in a boarding house in Waterloo?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then finally, five of us got together and rented a big showroom in the hotel where the salesman had all their stuff.
Was it a small enough league where you could come home every night?
No, I was in Waterloo, Iowa, and my home was in...
No, I mean where the team would come back every night, or did you go on the road?
Oh, we went on the road. We went on the road, and they'd get, you drive us or get a bus or something.
Mm-hmm. Then you were in Montgomery.
Yeah, that's right. Birmingham bought me, and he bought me with a broken leg. The scout that knows, he had seen me when I was throwing real well, and when it got towards the end of the season, I was playing with my right ankle in a cast.
You were playing?
Yeah, because you either play or go home.
Yeah,
in those days,
they didn't pay you if you got hurt.
That's right. Anyhow. A guy by the name of Bill Peart had scouted for Birmingham. I bought my contract for $750.
Mm-hmm.
And all winter long, he kept calling me. His home was in Birmingham. And all winter long, he would call me. He wanted me to go out dancing and build that thing up. He said, "Are you dancing?" I said, "Yeah, I'm dancing. I'm doing everything you asked of me." And the first thing I got to spring training, he met me at the train. The chief.
See if you could dance.
To see if I got, could take that or had the cast off, and I was okay.
Hmm.
Well, then Birmingham sent me to Montgomery. They had about four or five big league catchers at Birmingham at that time, including a real good hitter by the name of Yam Yarian, whose name was synonymous with not only Birmingham but the entire Southern League.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a couple more ex-big leaguers there, and so I didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
They sent me to Montgomery.
Who was the manager of Montgomery?
You're not awful now that you ask me. I can't think of a name. Oh, that irks me. And I had Roy Ellum.
Roy Ellum.
Yeah, he's finally. He was kind of a fatherly, godfatherly type,
And in Birmingham, who was the manager?
Clyde Mylan was at Birmingham, uh-huh. And a very good person as far as I was concerned. He was not only a tutor, but he was like a godfather to me.
Uh-huh.
He could overlook some of my mistakes, but he liked my enthusiasm. I know my second or third year there, I said, "You think I've got a chance to ever get to the big leagues? I was comparatively small." So he said, "Well, I'm going to tell you something." He says, "You're going to go to the big leagues." He says, "Your enthusiasm and your work and your ability will take it, but you'll never be a good big league hitter." But he said, "I believe this." He says, "That as observing as you are, as cooperative as you are, you will always have a job." But he said, "I want you to know that. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be an easy role for you because you don't have the physical attributes, to drive that ball." He said, "But your defensive work will keep you around."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Now, you don't get discouraged." And that's the way it's been all my life.
What was it like playing in Montgomery and Birmingham during the Depression?
It was sad. We had one year in Birmingham where it looked real tough, financially wise for everybody. And I remember all the ball players took a cut. I mean, a pretty good cut. In those days, anything, if you mm-hmm. took $100 a month or $200 a month cut, that was fine. And that's how things worked out. I mean, we got the year, but boy, it was hot. We had all day games,
Yeah.
And I didn't have the size to begin with. I think when I came home the first year, I weighed about 127 pounds
or
something like that. And my mother got scared as a dick as I had to go to be examined by the doctor.
Did you, what kind of places did you stay in on the road during those years?
But we stayed at hotels, at pretty nice hotels.
So your living conditions in the on the road and the transportation were all right?
Yeah, we're all right. Yeah. Of course, we've had to sometimes ride a bus all night when I was in that southeastern.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But and then get out to the park and play on occasion. But as a whole, we were stayed at, you know, comparatively nice hotels.
Is there any particular fondest memory you have of your minor league days?
Oh, not when you ask me right now something like this, I can't think of mm-hmm. anything. But I remember this, when I was at Waterloo, Iowa, our meal money had to be stretched out pretty good. I never ate so many roast beef sandwiches, hot roast beef sandwiches, mashed potatoes and gravy. Oh, boy.
What were you getting, $1 a day?
Oh, at that time, no, I don't remember what we got at that time, but I'm talking about even when we were at home.
Yeah, yeah. You're on your own.
There's an old restaurant in Waterloo. The guy was quite a baseball fan, and he felt sorry for us kids.
Uh-huh.
He used to give us a ticket, and we, you know, worth so much for the week.
Meal ticket,
mm-hmm. and he'd punch it. Or yeah. No dessert. We had no money left for dessert.
And the ballparks? Was Rickwood Field there?
Rickwood Field was at Birmingham.
Yeah.
That was mm-hmm. a beautiful field.
Yeah.
It was so well dressed, shall I say, you know. It was immaculate. A lot of the big league clubs that used to train in Florida,
mm-hmm.
they were always welcome their day or two stay in Birmingham, because the infield was just slick as a book.
A big step up from Montgomery.
Oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah. How did the Dodgers then acquire you?
The Dodgers drafted me then in 1932.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I would say, besides signing, my first thrill in baseball was getting a professional contract to sign. Mm-hmm. Hell, I'd have signed for anything.
Yeah.
And then my next big thrill, naturally, was when I got to the big leagues, where I'd hoped to stay.
Yeah.
And then my arm acted up again in 1934 when I was with Brooklyn, and the next year I found myself in Sacramento, California. Mm-hmm. In the Coast League.
Your first encounter with Stengel, do you recall?
1934.
What your first meeting with him was like?
Oh, we sat down, we had a nice cordial conversation, and we talked about baseball in general. He was surprised at my size. He thought I was going to be a big guy. But he loved to see me throw, because at that time I had one of the best arms mm-hmm. in baseball.
Now, you went, that was your first spring training with a major league club then?
Yeah, it's 1934.
Mm-hmm. Where did they train?
They trained in Orlando, Florida. And boy, at that time that was a brickyard.
Yeah.
They said it was the only ballpark that had a main highway running through it. it was so hard.
You had a... some interesting pitchers in those Brooklyn days, 34 and then in 36. And
I'm sure you're going to mention Van Lingle Mungo.
Mungo was one of them, yeah. I'm curious about, you read so much about how close a pitcher and catcher have to be in thinking, and some people write that they're like almost like a married couple. You got to know each other well, and the pitcher has to have confidence in
That's
the catcher.
Right. It's a little bit...
How did you deal with that when you're the rookie catcher and you've got these Ray Benge and Dutch Leonard and Zachary and Babich and all these guys who are old heads?
Yeah.
How do you develop that?
To begin with, they were wonderful people. I mean, they had gone through the same thing at some time or another. Of course, in your meeting, the manager would hold a meeting and we'd discuss how we would like to pitch to certain hitters, and so you have a little knowledge of that before you begin with.
And the whole team sat in on the meeting.
The whole team sided in on the meeting. Because the infielders at that time, the second baseman and the shortstop, would relay to the outfield what the pitch might be, and you knew over a period of time where that ball, would, same pitch would be hit, and what now they have diagrams and computers. But anyhow, Van Lingle Mungo was a little bit on the high-strung side, temperamental a little bit, but at heart he was a real good guy. But in the competitive of the game, he'd liable to knock you down for no reason at all.
Yeah, my friend Dick Bartel got knocked down to start the season every year.
Yeah, he'd knock him down all the time. Mm-hmm. Either inadvertently or for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But see, Dick used to stand right on top of the plate, and Dick had one of those voices that you could hear all over, and he used it.
Mm-hmm.
He'd liable to call Van a big busher and, you know, and stuff. And Van, who had that short wick, he'd knock him down. But they tried to pitch Dick. He crowded the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to pitch him high and tight. Well, you know, when you start pitching high and tight, you're bound to nick somebody sometime.
Oh, right? Yeah.
But
he knew when the Dodgers opened against the Giants every year,
yeah,
he knew that he was going down. Yeah. When he let off against Mungo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember one time he bunted and made Mungo feel the ball. When Mungo bent over to feel the ball, Dick run right up his back. Well, a damn good fight ensued.
Yeah.
I said, Jesus, what's coming off here?
How quickly would you as a new catcher learn the pitchers, the repertoire and the pitches, and what a pitcher would want to rely on, so you could call a game?
Yeah, you do. Lots of times they would just maybe look you off if they didn't want to make that pitch. You know, you see today they'll flip their glove or they'll nod.
Mm-hmm.
But as a whole, it didn't bother too much. You know, you went with, you knew as a result of these meetings, you knew what you wanted to do. You know, and so you went along with it.
And how would you learn what these different pitchers, which of their pitchers they had the most confidence in?
Well, you learn that as time went on. I mean, you sit and talk with these people. Or lots of times you call you out and you say, now, Ray, I'd like to try this on somebody, you know. And you probably switch there.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn it through being with them and... You're talking about as a young kid coming up now. Now you sit and observe a lot because you know, your mistakes in spring training are overlooked a lot, especially if you're young. And then you're supposed to remember as time goes on.
Yeah, yeah. You had two hitches with Stengel, but what was he like during the game in the dugout as a manager?
Quite vociferous.
On the other team as well as his own guys?
Yeah. He'd catch you and ball you out for something you had done. Of course, me being a catcher, I was going to be responsible for a lot of balls that were hit out of the park. Well, I'd hear about it once in a while.
Right in front of everybody else?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There's a lot of good can be said about Stengel. I would have to say that he'd give you a try. He got rid of me. Well, he traded me a couple of times, or once out to the Coast League. And then when I went to Louisville, Burley Grimes traded me for an outfielder. And before the season was over, I went back to Pittsburgh. And that was the start of a long career in the majors.
Yeah, yeah.
But
And on an 0-2 pitch, did these managers have any... If you gave up a home run on an 0-2 pitch, you were in trouble?
Sometimes. It all depends, you know... Let me say you're a little grossly animated.
Or a little subtraction from the pay?
No, not necessarily.
No, fine.
Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest run-ins I ever had with Stengel, we were playing a ball game on a Saturday in Brooklyn, and they were hanging from the rafters. We were playing the Giants. And I forgot who the pitcher was. Anyhow, oh, Mungo again. And I can't remember the guy's name that was hitting. He was a good high fastball hitter. Mungo was a good fastball pitcher. And there's a guy don't hit one up in the seats, and we get beat. Well, the thing was furious. We come into the clubhouse, and he's starting to chew me out, you know. He said, I kept 10, 15,000 people out of the park the next day. And he kept us up and kept us up. I think I was there for I don't know how long. And he said, I want you to sit there and think about it, and I'll tell you when you can take that uniform off. So finally, I got a little irritated too, and I says, Case, I just read in this morning's paper where you haven't won a ball game in Pittsburgh, in Brooklyn on a Saturday in 2 years. How come you never jumped on Lopez? And that was the wrong thing to say. So, so but I'll never forget, Zach Taylor was one of the coaches, and he had the locker right next to me. He says, keep quiet, he says, you don't even, you're getting them more stirred up than ever.
Do you subscribe to the philosophy that when the pitcher's strength is the same as the hitter's strength, you go with your strength anyhow?
Yeah, in certain to a degree. Lots of times you'll inculcate. You'll try to get somebody thinking, and you'll probably cross them up. Like a lot of times you'll see where a hitter will take that third strike right down the middle. It's only because he's looking for another pitch,
which he's not supposed to be doing, especially with two strikes on him.
Those are chances that you take. Mm-hmm. You can't become mechanical all the way through because they have a book on you too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so they look for that pitch a certain time. But as a general rule, you go to their strength. Like if you're a single ball pitcher, you don't throw somebody a high fastball.
And if a guy is a low ball hitter, you still got to go with your sinker.
You still have to go if the guy has a real good sinker. If the ball has some velocity to it and sink it. But lots of times, as the game progresses, you know, you're getting down in the tight eighth and ninth inning, he might lose a little of his velocity and all the ball will sink, but it won't snap off.
Yeah.
So you have to watch for those things too. Oh, it's an interesting life, really.
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah. What was your
quite an education at times.
What was your attitude on the slider?
It wasn't as pronounced as it is today. It wasn't used as much. But there was people like Ray Benji, you mentioned his name. That was the first one that I encountered. I played with guys in the minor leagues that had it, you know, old-timers. Mm-hmm. You know what they call it? A nickel curve,
yeah. I was told that Bill McKechnie just hated the slider.
Well,
he said the slightest mistake you make with a slider, they'll kill you.
It happens. Of course, it's like hanging a curveball.
And he did not want his pitchers throwing a slider.
See, some of them, I think it was an abused pitch. I'm talking as time went on and maybe to the present day. See, it has been a strain on some arms because it's not correctly delivered.
Mm-hmm.
See, a lot of deliveries aren't conducive to throwing sliders or good curveballs. So they have to resort to something else.
Yeah.
But so many times the guy trying to develop a slider will do something wrong and snapping that thing off, he comes up with nine times out of ten, but he comes up so frequently with a bad elbow. You hear about so many guys today with all the operations on their elbow and the rotator cuff. That's a result of bad deliveries, as a rule. And this is where, as time went on, I learned something about it. I was showing you that picture over there with those old-timers.
Mm-hmm.
Just from observing them work, and I had them in mind all the time. The guy with a good delivery is a guy that lasts 8, 10, 12, 15, 17 years.
Now, can you look at a pitcher, a young pitcher, and tell by his delivery that he should not throw those pitches?
Yes. This is where I made my delivering and my living. like you, I was telling him, Mylan says, I was observing. I'll always love to talk to pitchers. And I had the good faculty of being able to catch the ball wherever they threw it, because I knew by their initial movement where that ball would have to go.
Uh-huh.
And as time went on, it became progressively easier for me and better. I could spot you that quick. After I became a coach and I get some of these, with the White Sox, and I get some of these young guys in spring training, especially, and go into their farm system once in a while, and I tell them where the ball was going before they even hardly delivered it. By their initial movement, I knew where the ball had to go. Some of them were hard to convince. They wouldn't believe it until I'd stand over there and look at them. I'd say, it's high, it's over here, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And
so there could be young pitchers today who go to spring training and say, I'm working on a slider,
yeah,
who shouldn't be doing that.
That's right. That's right.
But nobody's telling them not to.
Well, yeah, there will be a time. You see that picture of Tommy John up there?
Yeah.
There was a story he had told some writer in New York, and the guy in Racine copied it. And somebody gave that to me. I took the slider away from him because it affected his sinker. He was a good left-hand sinker, and it changed his delivery. He used to be high away with the ball breaking high away from the right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
I changed him to run where he'd break it down away from the right-handers. And I took the slider away from him because it was this versus that. And you know what that does to your elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, I say, okay, you can showcase it, you know what I mean, show it occasionally, but don't make it your pay pitch. Your pay pitch is your sinker. And if you're going to come up with a bad elbow, just as sure as God made little apples, well, you're fooling around with that slider too much. He used to call me once in a while when he was out on the coast prior to this, and he said, Ray, did you catch me on TV? Once in a while, I said, yeah, did you catch such and such a game on TV? I said, yeah, you're throwing too damn many sliders. And ultimately, he had to have
that new arm.
That new arm, yeah.
You think that that's the kind of thing that accounts for the large number of pitchers who are disabled?
It's got to be something. It's either a bad delivery. I have to be demonstrative. And I can't with that mic because it won't work.
Yeah.
I get a big kick out of reading about some of the expressions that they had, some of them that I'd used a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that there are no new pitches? They're just different names?
Well, there's a lot of different names.
But they're really not new pitches.
We had the pitch at the White Sox we called the slip pitch. It was something like a palm ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of mine that I picked up. I just threw fooling around. I was always doing something with a ball.
And the split fingered fastball?
Yeah. That's just like your fork ball.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing new. Yeah. There isn't anything new today. Years ago, they're still every once in a while spitting on it and nicking it. Well, you see, it doesn't take much to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can nick that ball on the outside, especially a ball that's really shiny. You can nick it here and go whoosh, or you can put it on underneath and go whoosh,
mm-hmm.
or you can put it on the one side and go, but you have to have the delivery for it. I don't care what pitch you have, if you don't have a delivery for that pitch, it's no good to you, because it's wear and tear in your arm. It's ball 1, 2, 3. Now, we had a pitcher, I hate to mention names, we had a pitcher that we picked up, could throw hard, and he was a bug on changeup. It was an unorthodox thing, and every time he'd throw it, and if he didn't get a strike on it to get the hitter out, he'd wind up losing the guy, either by virtue of a base on balls or a ball up in the seats, only because he couldn't get back in the same strike zone. He'd
mm-hmm.
choke it off here, now he'd come back with his good stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it was a promiscuous pitch. And so he'd get madder than heck, because I'd tell him, you can't use him. The only way I got around him without offending him or getting in an argument, I used to have good cooperation with Sherman Lawler when I was with the Sox. He wouldn't call for it. So, I mean, there's so many things that and so many ways of doing things.
And it's and you say that to throw a curve, there are some deliveries where he shouldn't be throwing a curve.
There's some deliveries where he can show it, and if it's a bad one, he should only show it, you know. But
yeah.
And there's so many.
I mean, as far as hurting the arm is concerned,
there's so many things that go to. Not all of us. Now, like, I had a real good wrist, you know, for throwing, but I could never throw a curve. I didn't have the wrist for it. So that's why you see some of them don't have a good curve. Some have a slider. It's easier for them. But there again, you come back to grips and deliveries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, if, for example, if I were coming to you and my delivery was such, I couldn't get that ball where there's no way I can get that ball there without straining to get it.
Yeah.
Right? But if I came here like this, how easy it is. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And if I do this, the ball's got to be high. You can't. I see pitchers going along, even now, and it bugs me. I'll see them get out of rhythm. I mean, they'll get to going like this, or say some of the guys that do this, that's fine. But if they do this, and then this, they're ready to go. But if they do this, and then start, they can't get up here to get the ball down.
Yeah.
You see, I see these things. So in the 22 years I was with the White Sox, I never had a bad arm. Because I watched. I saw where you were straining, and I'd watch you in spring training. Your first games were maybe extending yourself a little bit too much. And I'd watch you the next day, and as soon as you pick up the ball, you know, to loosen up a little bit, and I'd see your head go flinch like
mm-hmm.
that. I said, oh, that's a result of yesterday.
Did you ever have any hard heads that you just couldn't get through to?
Once in a while, yeah. The hardest ones were the young kids.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest ones were the guys. I had very... Geez, I sound egotistical, don't I?
No, not yet.
I had a lot of success with the borderline guy, the guy that was getting sent back, and maybe I'd see him warm up. When I'd always go to the park early and watch the opposition work out and do things. And I'd see these guys like Shaw, there's Tommy John, and a bunch of them. And I'd say, the reason you're not staying in the big leagues, I think, is because of this, that, and the other. And I said, I think if you cooperate with me, I'm sure you can help us as much as we can help you. But you have to go along with me. I've got mm-hmm. authority enough to keep you around that where you have a damn good chance, you know, where you, to look at you. We picked up Pizarro one year.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how these names come to me. They don't mean anything to you, hon.
Oh, I know Juan Pizarro, yeah.
Like Pizarro, when he get to go to the back to the plate, he'd go like this, see? And then the ball would go high. And it was a tough job taking him from this.
Plate arching his back.
Arching his back.
Mm-hmm.
You take a lot of pitchers that arch their back, they have a tough time getting the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd arch his back, and there's always a tip-off to the base runner. As soon as he went back like this, they'd go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a job with him, and he got mad at me. And I said, stick with it now, you'll get it. And all of a sudden one day, he did it in the bullpen. You know how he happened to do it? He just got disgusted one day, and he took the ball and threw it back to the pitcher, to the catcher. Instead of arching his back,
mm-hmm.
he just went, he threw it all to hell with it, and he went like that. And I said, hey, that's the very thing I'm trying to get through to you. And he says, you mean I'm that dumb? And he got it, and geez, what a year he had for us now.
Mm-hmm.
And I called the bench one day when this happened and got him going and says, hey, Al, we're getting beat that day. I says, let's run Pizarro in there. I says, I think he's got what we've been trying to get through his head.
Mm-hmm.
He says, okay, send him in. Geez, he went through real good. And he thought that was great. From then on, I had no problem with him.
Would you say that he's one that you're most proud of?
Proud of all of them.
But if it was somebody that really You really turned around?
I turned, picked up Bob Shaw from Detroit. Same thing as they, he was warming up, loosening up, just get, you know, keeping in shape because they weren't using him. And I saw him with a nice live arm, and, but I didn't like his delivery. And all of a sudden, he too, the last disgusted pitch that he threw, it was what I liked, and I remembered it. And when they sent him out, he refused to go out. He went back home and quit. And we picked him up, and I told him just exactly what had happened. And I said, no, you're either going to have to go along with us in our thinking, or we're going to have to turn you back. He said, geez, I'll do anything you ask if I only get a good chance to stay. You'll get a good chance to stay. And when he picked it up, he went overboard with it. He'd walk down the street like this. We were walking down Michigan Boulevard with Lopez one day, and we got past the Stevens Hotel and a couple other places with the big windows. Here he was, as he walked by, he looked at himself in the mirror and keep going. And Lopez says to me, he says, hey Ray, look at your protege over there. Son of gun, he helped us win the pennant that year. He won about 18 ball games. But
of course, that was in the days before the guaranteed multi-year contracts.
Oh, God, yeah.
Where they had to listen to you if they wanted a job.
Well, that's where I had a lot of my modicum of success.
You and Al Lopez still keep in touch?
Well, we talk once in a while. At Christmas time, he sends me a card too. But I talk to him once in a while. I'll be talking to him now in a few days when I hear some more about Gutridge. We're very, very close friends of Cuccinella, myself, and Lopez, Johnny Cooney.
Some of you were in Brooklyn and then in Boston too.
Yeah. And of course, Gutridge was there when Lopez took the club over.
Yeah.
And we were real close. It was a wonderful thing. We got along beautifully. We could argue with something and tell all you're full of bunk, you know. But when the thing was all over, we got along real well. We kid each other. And
yeah, nobody took it personally.
No.
Yeah.
No, it was very good.
Can you tell me when and why the four-man pitching rotation expired and the complete game disappeared?
I think the thing has been grossly exaggerated. I mean, as far as running these pitchers in right and left-handed, they're doing it in the early part of the ball game. I don't know. I have been away now for about 27 years, you know, from the big league and the minor leagues too. And I don't watch it too much. I don't know what's going on. I can't exactly say. I can only dream this or think this. I don't know if it's a way that they build them up in spring training. Now they seem to think now, if you go five innings, six innings, wonderful. Bring in somebody else to save it for me.
Yeah,
that's the way. Years ago, those guys they'd fight you tooth and nail. Oh, crap, you like early win of those guys. You see somebody warm up in the bullpen.
Yeah.
Vaughn, not Vaughn, but I'm trying. I can't think of the name now today. A lot of those guys. Look at Johnny Sain and
Spahn,
they'd go nuts.
Yeah.
The longer the game went. Now, I don't know if they're not training them, the long haul or not.
Well, you read all about it. The athletes today are bigger and stronger and all this stuff.
That's right.
And nobody can pitch 200 innings.
I don't know if it's in the training or what. But I don't know about for all the sore arms either. Like, it must be in a type of delivery. It must be, I don't know if it's the way you're handled or what you're supposed to do.
Did you have your pitchers throw every day?
No.
What would the routine be for starting?
You see, you can't handle everybody as a whole. This was my theory now. What you could do, he couldn't do. You might be you might be sore as the devil the next day. He might be feeling fine. Your arm, it so much depends on your physique, so much, but most of it depends on your delivery. Most of it depends on what was the abusive pitch. What was the one that wore you out today?
Mm-hmm.
Like, say you're throwing maybe too many breaking balls. Say, like Tommy John up there.
Didn't your starting pitchers throw batting practice between starts?
Yeah, not lots of times. And when I first come into the big leagues, a pitcher would probably pitch today, rest tomorrow, pitch batting practice that day, rest the day, and then go again. But see, your schedule sometimes interferes with that, where you probably have to give them a complete rest, or say you rest them today and then lightly throw them today and rest them. It all depends on the individual, like I say, and all the mechanics.
Yeah.
See?
I think, didn't Johnny Sain throw flat, not off a mound?
Johnny Sain had one of the best deliveries. He had a delivery that was conducive to throwing every day. But he's not the guy that had the unorthodox delivery that was herky-jerky.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of a herky-jerky pitchers ever lasted over a period of years.
Yeah. And Spahn also was... Well,
he had a real smooth.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of that... And that pitching staff that I just showed you over there, they're the one that I could remember. Their deliveries, they were all smooth.
Now, can you teach that, or is it just natural, you got it or you don't?
Of course, they used to tell me my pitching staff was a clone. You know, they were all clones to a degree. But you can with some people. It's just like you see, you play golf?
No.
Do you play golf?
I used to.
Did you ever see him at a driving range?
Yeah.
And you compare him with the pro with that real good.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Now you see this guy? That's the difference.
But we're dealing with all pros here.
Makes no difference. It's all dependent on how you're being handled. Like you've got some guys that aren't effective, you know, better sidearm pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Sidearm pitchers don't last a lot of the time unless you've got a good live fastball that'll sink or something, because the left-handers will eat you up.
Mm-hmm.
You've got that better view of it and confident too. But it's mechanics, mechanics, mechanics. But you cannot practice theory unless mechanically you can do it. Am I right or wrong?
Mm-hmm.
If I told you to throw a ball over there and it went over there, there's something wrong.
But if my mechanics are all messed up, and I'm herky-jerky and throwing across my body and everything, can you teach me? Can you straighten it out?
Yeah, if you're cooperative.
Yeah, but physically you can do it.
Physically you can do it to a degree. But I wouldn't take it away from you if you were more effective that way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a hitter. He may have a Stan Musial stance, but if he can hit, leave him alone.
It's just, I don't, like a lot of those hitters, no matter what you do, when it come right down to that second, they were already gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you do the same thing. There's no things as closely associated together as a pro golfer's good swing and a pitcher's good delivery. They're both the same. They all say stay behind the ball, you know, like you stay here. If you get out here, you know where the ball goes? Over there. Same way of pitching. If you get here, the ball goes there. But so you lay back. In golf, you come back. In pitching, you continue on.
Were you as good a golfer as a pitching coach?
No, hell no. I tried to hit the ball as far as everybody else. I was one of those dummies too. And still am. See all those clubs over there? Because some of them are my boys and some are my wife's and some are mine. But I'm an avid golfer. I'm not a good golfer.
How important is it for that front foot to come down in the same place every time?
It'll automatically come down. You know, they always used to, a lot of times you say you're releasing the ball too soon, or you're releasing it. It's the reason, there's a reason for it, for being up there all the time. Now you take it, like I say, it's as simple as you walk. like I tell some of the fishermen. See, it's right here. Now supposing I do this, now I come back here. Right? But if I do this, I can't do that. So you stop doing this. And then this is what I used to watch all during the game when they'd start those things. I used to keep a record of. And I'd mark all the pitches against each hitter. I said, here's where you started this monkey business. Instead of here, you were going like this.
Mm-hmm.
See? And that's where you, and I'd mark it. And when you start, couldn't get back into here again, you know, see here, you stay back. I'm getting all my leverage, right? And when I get out here too soon, I'm still here. There's no way I can throw that ball where I want or where I'm supposed to. But what the heck was I going to say?
Because sometimes you'll see marks all over the place where a guy's coming down in different places with that front foot.
That's right. But that good guy, he'll lay in there all the time. And it'll come automatically. Like some of them will come like this. They see how I'm hanging?
Mm-hmm.
You know the reason for it? I'm not getting that out of the way.
Yeah.
See, all these little things I see. I don't try to change anybody drastically. I just tell them what I think. Let's try it. You aren't getting by mm-hmm. with it your way. Let's go the other way.
What does it mean to say that the pitcher is flying open?
This. See, he gets like this.
Okay, he's turning his chest toward the plate before he's ready to throw.
He's opening up, and consequently you see that ball quicker. But if I stay here until I'm driving at you,
it's that front shoulder continuing on facing toward the plate.
Yeah. Here? Mm-hmm. But you have to open up someplace. I don't care. See, you open up there. A lot of guys open up here. And you see the, and you'll see pictures sometimes where the guys are like that. It's because they're flying open.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get that L in there. See?
That's what Nolan Ryan was doing when he was young and wild.
Yeah.
Until they cured them of it.
Yeah. And see, sure, they're going, the kids will go, you can't throw as hard that way. You think you are. And that was one of the things I had trouble with a lot of the young guys. They said, well, you're making me too deliberate. I'm not throwing that hard. I said, if I had a gun on you, you'd see where you're throwing just as hard with less,
effort?
Yeah, less effort.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all, you do your work, you do your preliminary here. See? You can't do your preliminary on the way to the thing. See how simple it is?
Yeah.
I made a good living out of it.
Now, when you got a man on base, and they have to do what they call a slide step now, doesn't that throw you off of
that's
your delivery?
Right, it can, see. You can't, you probably can't do that with a big guy with a long arc. Because when you do that, you see where I am? If I could be here and then do it, I'd be all right. But if I'm going one way with the body and the other way with the arm, they get some guys.
But if you haven't got it here, you haven't got it. You can't. I needed you. I won't tell you, I needed you 50 years ago because I couldn't throw hard. And they say you can't teach a guy to throw hard.
That's true. You probably, with some of them you can, with some of them you can't. Some of them are denying themselves their leverage and consequently can't throw hard. Me, I was one tiny little guy as compared, I could throw as hard as anybody. When I was in the prime as a kid, now I'm bragging again. I hurt my arm and I learned how to throw differently and quicker. Quickly and accurately. And if you were my pitcher, when my arm was good, and when you came down here and threw that ball, and I didn't throw that ball that went like that. I'd hit you right in the chest. But I hung around because of my defensive work.
Yeah, I've seen fastball pitchers who were all sizes and shapes.
Yeah.
It's not how big you are that counts.
It's where you can move that ball, where you can start that hitter wondering. The last World Series showed me some of the best pitching I ever saw in a whole series. They made Cleveland look silly. Mm-hmm. Everything was off the plate, and they were chasing it.
Mm-hmm.
And when they, if they didn't chase it, now they have to come in with it. They had another pitch to come in with, like the changeup, or the slider was there, or anything. Now there's some guys got sliders, some guys don't have sliders.
Mm-hmm.
See, so you learn what's the guy's best pitching.
Did you work with or see or catch any better pitchers than Maddox?
Oh, now you got me thinking again. Hubbell was of that type. You know,
well, that's pretty good company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see now, how many pitchers have got? How many pitchers have Maddox's delivery? He's real easy. He's got a short arc, right? He's here. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a lot of that. And he's got such good control because he's got such a good delivery.
Mm-hmm.
If he had an unorthodox delivery, he wouldn't be able to make those pitches.
Yeah.
I mean, when he'll come in here, and you come in here, and all of a sudden the ball he wants you to hit is that one down there, he'll get you back you up a time or two, and you sneak one by there. All right, now the next time you come up, he'll have to do the opposite with you. He might start you out there to get you looking for it, and all of a sudden, boom, he pops you in here. But if you don't have the delivery, the mechanics, you can't practice theory. You can't do those things. And this is what I harped on all the 22 years I was with the White Sox. And we never had pretty good defensive club, but we never had what you call a home run or a big scoring club. And so we had to be careful with our pitches. But just to throw promiscuously and hard is no good either.
I know a guy named Rex Barney used to do that. Hubbell used to say that in the Polo Grounds he couldn't work the corners because of the way the Polo Grounds was laid out. Throw it down the middle and let them hit it 450-500 feet into the outfield.
There was an old guy over there, Ray Call, who was 45 years old, pitching for us against Houston 1 year in 1931, the little Dixie League Championship, and they had Medwick and all of those big strong guys. And he was watching them work out and batting practice and that. I said, "Hey, aren't you nervous?" I said, "Well, I am." He said, "What should I be nervous about? I forgot that he was in the big leagues for a number of years." he'd get Medwick up there who could hit that ball 9 miles, and he'd throw it mediocre speed, and instead of getting it over the plate, he'd get it inside. Wow, and he'd hit it, pull it left, and he'd pull it foul, and he'd probably come in again with one in there with nothing on him. He'd rip it again, foul. Now the next pitch that he wanted to get him out, and he'd go down away from him because he was in here to rip it. No, he had to hit it like that. You see, this is what you have to practice as a pitcher, to be able to do those things.
Yeah.
But because before you can do these things, you have to have the mechanics.
And obviously, there aren't many guys who can do those things.
That's right.
They set a record last year of the major leagues, 585 pitchers they used in both leagues.
I think it was 1954, Cleveland had 77 complete games.
Oh, yeah, well, that's okay. Sure, you had Wynn and Garcia and Lemon and Feller,
That's right, but they all had the delivery.
Yeah.
You talk about Wynn. When he started slipping at Cleveland, we got him in Chicago, and he wasn't winning for us. And I didn't want to say anything because he was a star at that time.
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't volunteer anything. And finally he says to me, "Ray, can you tell me what I'm doing wrong?" I says, "I'll tell you right quick." I says, "Your good delivery is this. This is his good delivery." Now when he got mad at somebody, he'd go, instead of going like this and around and up, he'd go, he'd take that club around the back of him, and that forbade him to get back up here. And I says, he says, "You mean it's as simple as that?" I says, "It's as simple as that."
And he would get mad.
Oh, he'd get mad. And then he'd be ball one, ball two, ball three, especially if somebody hit one back through the middle at him. he was a good competitor. But it was as simple as that. And when we'd fool around, you know, and he'd get that nice, he'd
I'd call it the figure eight with him, you know, that nice figure eight. Oh, geez, one day I brought out a little box of match, one of those little match,
little matchboxes.
A little paper matchbox. Yeah. And I put it and I said, Earl, I think you can pitch to this. And he laughed and he... I know I used to sit on the bench and I holler, no, Early. But they used to, you know, a lot of times they say he wouldn't give his grandmother a good pitch. It's, lots of times he'd be mad, see. Yeah. And when he'd get in that groove, he couldn't get back out of it again.
It's like they say, half of this game is 90% mental.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
when you, back in your playing days, can you recall if there was any book on these guys or how you pitched to the big hitters in the National League at the time? For example, the Wainers.
Holy cow, you know, they had those quick hands. We tried, if you made them hit the ball on the ground, they'd beat you out. They could run like hell if the infield was back. And a lot of times they pitch that ball high on him and away and try to make him hit the fly ball. But Jesus, they could do things with that bat. Little Lloyd would peck at it and run like hell. Or Paul would come up and he'd sting one once in a while. And he hit that ball. He was the closest thing that I ever saw as being hit them where they ain't.
Mm-hmm.
And Wee Willie Keeler and all that. He was the closest thing. He approximated the closest.
Yeah.
You know, the,
I've been told that he could hit a pitch wherever it was pitched. He'd hit a line drive somewhere.
Yeah. He'd get the. He always called it the fat of the bat and the meat of the ball.
And when he was teaching batting with Milwaukee, when he was a coach, it was the quick belly button he wanted.
Yeah, he wanted that.
Yeah.
Lay back and then snap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the belly button he called.
Yeah.
You do that in golf, they tell you what he said. When you get through, you're supposed to be like that. Mm-hmm. See, I can do it now. I got those pain pills in me. Normally, I can't get up out of the chair when I don't have it. It hurts me that bad. My hip and my groin.
Yeah.
But like I told you, I said, made a mistake this morning and took two.
Wow, I see you're in good form.
Oh, no.
And Mel Ott.
Mel Ott, I used to tell them when I joined the Giants, I said, Mel, why did you never start that hitter in front of you? As you know, like Johnny Rucker, these names come to me. He could run like hell. He never stole any bases because he went for the long ball. When Mize was there, when I was there, and I said, well, you don't hit and run with those guys because if they hit the right field, the guy goes from first to third anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, what the hell, Johnny Rucker? I said, why wouldn't you let him run in front of you? He said, well, I wanted that hole open, you know, between the second base and first baseman. And I said, Jesus, he said, well, why do you ask? I said, you know how you hit like this? I said, you were always blocking me out. I was having a hell of a time going there. And then he threw that leg over. You know, and the owner, Jesus, I remember Munger used to knock him down every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd call his Munger, or Mel would cuss him up. And he says, I'm not going to repeat it. Anyhow, you knock him down, you know, instead of, like now you see some of the guys fly up all over heck. Like a lot of those guys, right-handers that step into the pitch and it's up in here,
mm-hmm.
they have a hard time getting out of the way because they have to really drop. Well, he'd go down on that one foot and come right back up. He was so strong in his legs.
It always looked to me, Bobby Bonilla is a little similar. Bonilla will vary his, whereas Ott didn't.
Yeah.
But I would think that that would be the easiest kind of hitter to throw off his timing.
See, there's another thing. It will throw off your timing, but those good hitters that could handle that change of pace, years ago, they didn't throw it so much with two strikes because you were taught in certain situations to protect the plate.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you aren't necessarily going for the long ball, but today they're all striding to hit that thing, not even the little guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember McGraw, when I first come up, I remember McGraw giving somebody hell for swinging at a change of pace, on like on a 1-0 count or something, mm-hmm. or whatever it was, I don't remember. And the guy said, "Well, he's fooled me." He said, "Well, Jesus, do you have to hit it?" He said, "Spit on the damn thing." Take it, in other words. Then, if you have to hit it to the opposite field.
Yeah.
Because you're all spent, so you just,
mm-hmm.
you know. But you don't see those things anymore.
I want to know if my memory is right or wrong, that there were no such things as half swings. And this, what do they call it today? Check swing.
Check swing, no.
There wasn't when you were playing.
You mean like the umpires call it from one?
Yeah.
No. It's up to the umpires.
I mean, you either swung or you didn't.
Yeah, your umpire's decision, you know, whether you went through or not. But I think it's grossly magnified today, you know. But geez, we never saw the guys get out so far in front as often as they are now, and it's only because they're all swinging from their butt.
That's what I seem to remember.
Yeah.
I mean, the check swing was non-existent in those times. What about the guys like Medwick and Mize? Could you pitch to Medwick, or would he hit anything anywhere?
The best luck we had with Medwick was pitching right down tight on that knee, you know, that knee that he had anchored. Because you couldn't do it too often, he'd wheel on you.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, and Mize was, of course, he was a damn good hitter. You know, he laid back. Now there's another thing you can't teach to the guys. So he'd lay back until that last second and then come through. Some guys can't do that.
He had a perfect level of swing.
Oh, he had a beautiful, and he had a nice, big, well-balanced bat. I used to have one here. I give it away this summer.
Mm.
No, I had a guy from Florida call him. He'd give me a bundle of any bats or anything I had. I'd give it all the kids in the neighborhood around here. And
about an old story.
Telling
an old story.
Oh.
Ernie Lombardi, how would you pitch to Ernie
right
Lombardi?
On that knee. You know how he hit? There again. When I was at Pittsburgh, when I joined him in 37, I said, "Jesus, you guys are pitching him? Wow, and you're having luck." I think they must have beaten Cincinnati about 22 times. I don't know. And he said, Lon could handle a bat. He could hit and run with anybody. He could hit to all fields. And he was so strong. But he's anchored. And he pitched right in there. And if he went after it, you cut him out. But God, I saw him hit some awful shots.
Oh, yeah.
He'd hit him over that third baseman and go like a tennis ball.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody ever hit a ball harder.
No.
Mm-mm.
He couldn't run. He could catch and throw. And they made fun of him because he wasn't a classy catcher. Shoot, I'd see him time after time, the ball would be over here where he couldn't catch it. The dust and everything come up, he'd rub it off.
Yeah, he would take a new ball and rub it up with one hand.
Yeah, it was
throw
funny.
It to the pitcher. Yeah.
Jesus, you're talking about a story. We used to call him Snaz, and they called me Bugle because he was north, you know. And one day, I don't remember if Mancuso was catching or Lem was catching. Oh, Lombardi was catching and he got hurt. So I had to go in right away and I couldn't find my mask. So I grabbed his and put it on and it's fitting way back on me, you know. And I didn't realize that my nose was sticking out the bar. And don't you know, the first guy fouls one off and hits me. And the spin of that ball took all the skin off, and I bled like a stuck pig. Well, you never saw anybody laugh so much in all your life. Here's Lombardi hurt, and he's laying on that bench just sick laughing at me.
Bill Nicholson, were you catching when Ott walked him intentionally with the bases loaded?
No, I wasn't there then.
I thought it was 44.
44? Well, I remember of it having been done, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can't remember seeing it. Oh, Jesus, he could get in a streak every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
He made himself a good ball player. He had a lot of determination, a lot of stick-to-itiveness. He practiced and practiced and practiced what he was told he couldn't do. He became a pretty good outfielder.
Yeah, yeah.
And swish.
Yeah. That's the only time in the National League history that a hitter was intentionally walked on four wide ones with the bases loaded.
Yeah, I've been in it all my life, but I was never a buff that remembered some of these things.
And I want to ask you about Pete Reiser in 1941.
Oh, Jesus, how he'd run into those walls. It was, you know, he was a good base runner, and he could fly, and he could run so fast. And that was before the walls were padded.
Yeah. He had that one big year.
Yeah.
Oh. 340 something.
Johnny Cooney could have made him a lot better. I protected him from running into the walls. Johnny Cooney played the outfield for an old man. He was a pitcher, first baseman, everything. Graceful as could be. He'd run into those walls, and he knew that was there, and he put out that hand and maybe catch it like that. You know, he had that.
Mm.
And he'd run smack into the walls, and he'd hit, and it seemed like he'd glide right along them. Or Pete'd go, pow, right?
Yeah.
Flush into him. Oh, it was a shame for the ability that kid had.
Yeah. How would was there a lot of variation among the umpires when it came to calling balls and strikes?
Yeah.
Who did you want to see behind the plate?
Clem. Bill Clem, most consistent. And no nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
They'd holler catfish at him, and God almighty, he'd get mad, and neck would blow.
Did you ever get thrown out of a game?
No, not in the big leagues. I did in the minors once in a while. But Clem was going to throw me out one day. We were catching a ball game against Pittsburgh, and I don't know what the hell happened. We had to bring in Dutch Leonard. He was a young guy at the same time. And he threw that knuckleball so hard, and it's hard as hell to catch normally, you know. And as the day progressed, the shadow would sneak out in front of you. And you'd see it coming, and all of a sudden you kind of momentarily lose it. Well, Paul Wehner was the hitter. And it was, he was the last, we had to get him out to win the ball game. Loaded through the first knuckleball. Oh, and it went right through me, and it hit Clem in the foot. Oh, is he mad? Now he's limping around there. And I apologize. That was a tough goal. I forgot what he called it. Anyway, get back there. Jesus, it doesn't happen again. Oh, now he's really mad. He says, you're doing it on purpose. I said, how am I helping by doing it on purpose? We're trying to get Paul out. I said, we want to win this game. Anyhow, go for another knuckleball. And Paul Wehner struck out. You would have wound up with the ball in my bare hand. And then Clem laughed for a long time after that. I say, hey, knuckler. Knuckles coming, and he'd laugh. He says, don't you dare.
And
well, you heard stories about him. You must have. When,
of him and McGraw.
No, I mean, the stories were in Brooklyn, Philadelphia, in the old wooden ballpark, the two leather lungs. One would sit in the dugout on this side, one on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And they'd holler, hey, brother, did you go fishing? He says, yeah. What did you catch? Catfish! And that would go on all day. Oh, and Clem would get mad. But he was the best. Al Barlick was very good. I remember catching one of the first games that he umpired. Very, very consistent.
And who did you dread to see behind the plate?
Oh, God, I hate to mention it.
Well, it's all right. He won't sue you.
He's dead. I don't like to run anybody down.
Were there? I have heard that the pitcher has to pitch to the umpire as much as to the hitters.
Oh, I don't.
And you have to know whether this particular umpire gives you the low ball, doesn't, or
yeah, that'll happen.
If he's
some of them are got a wider plate,
yeah, or not, and you have to know who's who.
Yeah, but I think that could be discounted somewhat. You know, it happens, but it doesn't. It's not a regular thing to have happen.
I've also been told that umpires will give a veteran control pitcher pitches that he wouldn't give to a young guy.
Well, that probably happened, but I don't think that they deliberately offend anybody in that respect. But when you're wild, you don't know where the heck that ball's going. They're wild too.
It's a lot easier
to catch behind a control pitcher as it is for an umpire to work with, because you know you're always going to be around that plate and you're going to get some. You know. Because you're making that corner.
But if I'm a Messina or a Tewksbury or somebody with control, I'll get a strike that's an inch off the plate.
Yeah.
Whereas another guy who's all over the place will throw that identical pitch and he won't get it.
That'll happen, but yeah. I don't think that it's willfully done. I think it's something that's
subconscious.
Yeah.
Yeah.